This is Phyllis Gaylard. I'm 69 years old, and this today is October 26, 2007. We're in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm going to interview my friend Pamela Strong, but first a little bit myself, because I've got some stories too. I'm a retired aerospace engineer.
Let's let her say it too.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And then we'll get back to you.
Okay.
This is Pamela K. Strong. Today's date is October the 26th, 2007. The location is Nashville, Tennessee. And Phyllis Gaylard is going to interview me. What was I supposed to say? Okay, that's it.
Okay. I'm a retired aerospace engineer with some management as well. And I've worked on a number of different kinds of projects, some aircraft, spacecraft, lunar descent engine of the Apollo program, some ground stuff, some black hole stuff, can't tell you about. But it's been an interesting career, but I've been happily retired for 11 years and enjoying that very much. My friend Pamela has a different background than I, so we thought we would first have her tell you what she's done, and then we'll get into a little discussion here.
I was first a chemist, and now I are an engineer. Never took any engineering classes, but I have 3 fellowships in engineering and 2 in chemistry. Numerous awards in both, and a lot of on-the-job training in chemistry and in engineering. I am a rocket scientist predominantly now. I've dealt with all the Deltas and the Titans, have worked on aircraft, both commercial and military, just about everyone that you can name.
All right. My start in engineering was basically the influence of my father, who brought a lot of stuff home. He had Aviation Week in the house all the time, and I got interested in aircraft engineering, if you will, aircraft field of study. But in the days in the early 50s, it was men's careers and women's careers, and there the twain shall cross. But after rejecting secretarial, thinking about teaching and decided I didn't want to deal with those kids. I was going to be a mathematician until I thought, no, I'd rather solve my own problems. My dad took me to an engineering, not a career fair so much as an engineering career night program where engineers explained what they did and passed out information, and we found out I needed, this was my junior year in high school, that I was going to need drafting, so I went off and got started. I understand your background was quite different in that direction.
Oh, yeah. We lived in Alamogordo, New Mexico, just outside of White Sands, and we had 450 to 500 scientists and engineers traipsed through the house, some of which were Vannevar Brown, Albert Einstein, Glenn Seaborg, Linus Pauling, Robert Oppenheimer and his sister, whom I later actually studied under at Bryn Mawr, and lots and lots of others. And they were a big influence in my life.
And they got you going in experimenting in rockets?
Yes, they did experiment in rockets. At 4, I crawled up on Einstein's lap, and he gave me the theory of relativity. At 5, I made my own rocket, a composite rocket, that is wood and nails, and launched it and didn't go to the moon. He encouraged me.
Did it get up into a tree?
Oh, yes, it went all the way up to the top of the tree and then back down again and it didn't go to the moon.
Well.
Our propulsion was a piece of rope over the limb of the tree.
Your rocket was too heavy.
And the rocket was too heavy, yes.
Well, that's a great background. I didn't get those kinds of influences in my career, but I did choose engineering in high school, and I recall after that career night, I went in to do my senior schedule, and the guy that was doing schedules for us was the basketball coach. He said, girls don't take drafting. So he signed me up for home ec. And when he went out to coach the basketball team, I went back and switched it and took drafting and fixed him. So I went off to UCLA Engineering School and got my degree in engineering, which made it much easier than your history, which was quite different in that direction.
Well, yes, I had several different teachers that really influenced me. A Dr. Taylor, who was in ancient history in seventh grade, and I wanted to be an archaeologist until I found out how much they get paid, which was insignificant. And then I hit my professor, Dr. Murray Zagner, with a cork, and he thought that was a sign of a good chemist. And so he encouraged me in chemistry, and at the time I was taking a triple major, chemistry, biology, and pharmacy, and I was mainly going towards a pharmacy direction and changed to chemistry, and my parents wouldn't talk to me for 6 months, but that was all right. I was supporting myself anyway. So they later decided that maybe chemistry was okay. And let's see, I've made an AIDS cocktail, 13 marketed drugs. I have 82 in the pipeline, and that was during my graduate work. And now I am a rocket scientist.
Well, it's kind of neat to have commercial things like that out there besides stuff we can't talk about or even with military stuff. When I entered engineering, of course, I got some job offers through the high school, well, college, and started right out as an engineer without too much trouble. Subtle little things like the men I worked around in this un-air-conditioned office used to blow their cigar smoke up my little desk fan so I could choke and wheeze on it. But that was supposedly all in fun. Didn't have any real problems when I started. Later on, there was some subtle issues where people were trying to insulate me from things, which was really a holdback. Like the guy who said, "Oh, you don't want to go to these ugly meetings, I'll go for you." He took credit for my work. And a boss whose wife couldn't balance a checkbook, so he didn't want to bother me with the vagaries of pricing a proposal. And then he was out sick the day we had to price it, and I had to jump in and do it without any help. So little subtle things like that. But I gather your experience getting into engineering was a little different than that.
Slightly. I was a chemist. In fact, I was the first American employee of Henkel. And they sent me 9 volumes of instructions, all in German. So I had to translate them from German into English. And then 5 years later, they were going to get rid of that company, and they wanted me to start the research group, General Mills Chemical Division. But it was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where snow is truly a four-letter word. So I wanted to stay in California, and I walked down the street, got a job at Hughes, and they said, "Now you are an engineer." I'm going, "No, I'm a chemist." And they said, "No, you're a process engineer. Sink or swim." Well, I almost sunk, but I did do a good backstroke. And after that, I went to Irvine Sensors, and from Irvine Sensors, I went to General Electric, and from General Electric, then I went to Northrop, and Northrop to McDonnell Douglas. McDonnell Douglas was then merged with Boeing, and I even worked at what was the former Rockwell. And now I retired from Boeing and work at Aerospace Corporation.
Mm-hmm. I worked at Rockwell 3 times and retired from Rockwell before Boeing bought them out by about 6 months. Although Boeing sends me a pension, it's Rockwell I retired from. I heard it went downhill. Sorry about that. Major accomplishments. I did some interesting things on the lunar descent engine. We had some strange government requirements. One of which was that the moon lander had to withstand landing on a flat-topped, 24-inch-high rock without tipping over. So we had to have the nozzle extension that comes down out the bottom of the spacecraft collapse if it happened to hit something like that. Which is not, you don't normally design things to fail, to withstand all the load you need to up to a certain point and then crumble. Well, no loose parts, just squish. And we succeeded in that. We had an interesting test that they calibrated using corrugated tin trash cans with heat lamps on them and a squash test to make sure that they would collapse under that load. And a vibration test, they took a Goodyear racing tire, shaved the tread off it, and inflated it to provide a thrust force against it. And I said, oh, I'm racing a car, and they're taking the tread off that tire. I could have used it. But I didn't get to use it. So I got interesting things like that. Later, I got into working on a former Greyhound bus that we installed a wheelchair lift into for handicapped people, which is kind of a whole different ball game, but that was fun, too. So I've had some interesting things, you know, a few sweet recognitions, but you've got lots and lots of recognitions, I know, because I wrote you up for some of them, your fellowships and the like.
Yeah, well, we don't know whether we can get that one yet. But I think that's about the last one. Let's see.
Well, you got some highlights that
I have five different fellowships. I'm a Boeing Associate Technical Fellow, a Fellow of the Society for the Advancement of Material and Process Engineering, a Fellow of the Society of Women Engineers, a Fellow of the Royal Australian Chemical Institute, and a Fellow of the American Institute of Chemists. I remember them all.
Some of the things that you've done that gendered those awards, though, included developing the stealth materials that make the stealth bomber stealthy.
Oh, yes.
And a plastic jet engine, which everybody says plastic jet engine will melt. No, it didn't.
No, it didn't.
And saving all that weight on the rocket motors so that you could launch bigger spacecraft.
Well, I actually developed the material that allowed the stuff not to get burned up. It's good up to 7 and in some cases 800 degrees. It's called PMR-15. And because of the PMR-15, I was able to start an entire field of chemistry and subsequent engineering. They used PMR-15 on the inside of the General Electric aircraft engines, saving 464 pounds and $1.2 million in fuel per aircraft per year. Then that same material was used on the outside of the B-2 stealth bomber for structural aircraft. It was also used on the F-15 engine housings, later than on the F-18 engine housings, and the Mars rover heat shield. So, and that was just one of the many things that I've done.
But it's kind of setting new boundaries in the world of advanced composite materials.
Oh, absolutely. And pushing composites, for instance, we now have a Delta rocket that was less than 1% composites, and now it is over 70% composites of its structural weight, saving enough weight so that between 30 and 100 pounds of payload, depending on which of the deltas, of course, there's five different deltas, but 30 to five to 100 pounds of extra payload in orbit.
And that's
significant.
Absolutely, absolutely. So people who are not familiar with the aerospace industry might not realize, but advanced composites now find their way into car bodies and interiors and all kinds of housewares and things.
And that was from the aerospace industry,
sure,
and not from the auto industry.
And things like the Corvette. I went through the assembly plant yesterday. The Corvette used to be a big blown fiberglass in a mold, big thick thing, and I'm sure they're doing a much neater, fancier carbon fiber job these days than they used to.
Well, they should.
A lot lighter and stronger. Yeah,
yeah,
and it doesn't crack so fast. So it's an interesting field to have gotten involved in. I was peripherally using some of that stuff, but not very strongly. I got more involved in the metal stuff.
Well, composites are, or can be, five times stronger than that of steel.
Yeah, right. So when I was developing my career, I didn't have any mentors. So I was pretty much on my own. My dad encouraged me to get a master's in engineering, but that didn't pan out due to various strange reasons, so I got an MBA instead. since I got into management, but I gather you've had some mentors along the way that have helped.
Oh, I've had some wonderful mentors, and really that's why I am now the Inguineer that I really am now, and I keep mispronouncing it on purpose, because I don't want to belittle people who have actually gone and taken engineering classes, but there were five gentlemen, and I became the sixth composite person that did just about everything at General Electric. And these gentlemen were all in their very late 60s, mid 70s. And they took me underneath their arms. In fact, one of them would walk into the room singing, "Me and My Shadow." But I was only a shadow for about 2 weeks. And then they gave me my own project, which I successfully completed. 9 months after I started at General Electric, I won the prestigious General Electric Manufacturing Technology Award, and as far as I know, I was the only woman that had ever won that award. And it's only given to one person in all of General Electric.
Yeah.
And General Electric is, at that time, I think, was 1.5 million people.
That's a lot of people, and they did a lot of different things, too.
So I was very proud.
Yeah, absolutely. I kept running into odd situations where men wouldn't take my word for something. When I first started at TRW, my boss took me out to the shop to show me around and see if I knew anything about hardware. And surprise, I was working on a race car in my spare time. I knew all about hardware. And I was telling the designers that they weren't torquing the bolts tight enough to make them not loosen up under vibration in space. And, they'll break. So finally we had a standoff, and I went and did a test and showed the bolts would break under torque at about 5 times what they recommended. So we got all the bolt torques bumped up so they wouldn't back out under vibration. And it was another special project I got involved in that a guy dreamed up this, what they called a double doer, which a doer is basically a thermos bottle. And it was a thermos bottle inside a thermos bottle to keep a liquid
helium?
Helium, probably very cold, so he could do an infrared telescope out in space.
Helium.
And I looked at his design, and what he had done was build a conical thing with a flat bottom. And to reinforce the flat bottom, he'd put a series of ridges, but he made them circumferential, you know, circles instead of ribs. And what does that do? It looks like an accordion. And I said, this isn't going to work. They're going to expand and touch each other across this vacuum gap. Next thing I know, he's gone to my boss and said, she won't do, give me somebody else. So somebody else went and told him the same story, and he had to give up. They don't like to take our word for anything. Like, we don't know what we're talking about. But surprise, that was problems I had, but I don't think you had quite as much trouble as that. You had a few, though.
I had a few. I was the first signature on all the 6,000 drawings for the Delta II, the Delta III, and the Delta, all of the family of Delta IVs. There's five Delta IVs. And so they had to come to me and get my approval first. And this one young man was relatively new. He said, no, I'm the designer, I know. I said, well, you design it that way, it won't fly. And so he went back to his boss and he said, well, this Pam Strong, you know, she's just an M&P engineer, what does she know? And he proceeded to tell him what I knew and to go and do it my way. He came back, did it my way, saw how the part really worked, and goes, you know, the way I had it designed, it wouldn't have worked. And I go, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. He said, how did you know? I said, well, I've been out in the shop, and I've actually seen parts. Oh. And from then on, no one in his entire department ever gave me a problem.
Yes, that's what it takes. You have to show them
they're
wrong.
I ended up having to redesign and actually almost to design the entire rocket.
I worked with a lazy design engineer one time who said, minimum weight, I'm going to make it as grinny as I think, you know, as thin as possible. And he said, you prove me not that it won't work, and if it's not strong enough, you fix it. So I had to redesign everything he did because he made them all too light and too frail, and they'd fail. Mm-hmm. So I had to do all his work to make him fix it. but he was too lazy to do anything himself. So it's unfortunate. But
well, every once in a while I'd come up with these young kids.
Hard heads.
Wanted to make it. Well, the computer can make it to 5 decimal places. And I said, at what temperature are you going to actually ascertain that the 70-foot beam is going to be, you know, X long? And he goes, at what temperature? Forgetting thermal expansion, of course.
Yes. There's been so many fun things that go on in the shop. I'm watching. So I recall some other tests that were kind of fun. We had an orbiting geophysical observatory satellite. It was a big rectangular, looked like a file cabinet in space, with solar panels sticking out of it and some antennas. And they were having trouble with the thing. It was using up all of its gas that kept it lined up in row. And it had an antenna that stuck out that was a bimetallic thing that was coiled over. It was an open flat piece that kind of rolled over on itself and stuck out 60 feet. And we did a little quick lab test and discovered that when that thing swings, it doesn't swing like a straight stick would. It torques. And when you put the sun on it, it gets hot on one side, and that makes it expand and kind of move and stretch, and it swings in a kind of a figure eight instead of an arc. And that's what was wagging the dog. You know, it was a tail, so they had to cut it off, and that solved the problem. But we got to play with it in the lab and do a lot of funny things like that just to see what was going on. But the space program was fun, except that there were times when you couldn't find out what happened. I worked for a year and a half on a satellite program, developing an antenna that under thermal distortion from the sun, because it didn't rotate with the satellite, that it would still meet the criteria of flatness and shape and all this, so it would send a proper signal. It failed on launch. It never worked, and I lost a year and a half of work and don't know whether it was right or wrong, and it really frustrated me. And I learned from all of these things that what really made me like a job was to see that the end result worked. And so I found out that whenever I went job hunting, my goal was a job where I could follow a project through from start to finish and make sure how it worked and get involved in the hardware, because hardware's fun.
It really is fun.
Yeah, I know you've done a lot of work on the launch pads and with things like that, too. Like,
oh, yeah. Well, when they first brought me the plans for the Delta II, now the Delta II is sort of pregnant and comes down to an 8-foot, goes out to a 13-foot diameter and comes down to an 8-foot diameter.
Looks like an upside-down turkey baster?
Well, no.
And the bulb on top?
Sort of like the fairing itself, or the housing of the satellite. It looks extra fat.
Well, that's like the turkey baster bulb on top.
Yeah, okay. Or top, upside down.
Yeah.
And the wind, I kept telling him, have you put this in the wind tunnel? Oh, no, we don't need to. We know what we're doing. When it launched the first time, and I've never seen a launch since then, it was just as if it was in the wind tunnel. You could actually see the wind come down off the nose cone and impinge upon this smaller area. And the smaller area, exactly where it impinged, was where the gyros were.
Oh.
So the gyros were doing somersaults and backflips and whatever. And it kept sending a signal down to Earth saying, blow me up, I'm going the wrong way. Blow me up, I'm going the wrong way. And the poor range safety guy almost lost the rest of his finger. He was pushing the button so often and so hard. And finally it said, well, you have ignored me. I am going to blow myself up. So he had to send the abort, abort, abort signal. And so, because it was going up straight. And so the rocket didn't know it was going up straight, though. And so finally, after MECO, which is main engine cutoff, and the solids were gone and so forth, and the range safety guy went over and grabbed, and I do mean literally grabbed, our vice president, the Boeing or McDonnell Douglas vice president at that time, Reamed and dry cleaned him and told him his next bird was not going to move. And the next bird was ready for launch in 3 weeks. So I got on a plane with some vibration damping foil, and me and a whole group of people went up to the pad and put this 22-inch by whatever we cut it, 10-mil aluminum with 5-mil viscoelastic sticky stuff on to dampen the vibration, and we put it on in layers. Well, I was supposed to have assistants, but my assistant got sick. I think he went to Disneyland. And I never saw him again. So I had 3 shifts, 24 hours a day, that I was responsible for. Well, after the 4th day of no sleep, because all I had time to do was to go to the hotel and change, I got the first shift started, and this guy comes in about 2 or 3 minutes after the first shift starts, and I said, "It's okay. I don't care where you're late. Just go on over there. But go on over there." And I shook my little cane at him, and he went over there, and he put the first layer on, and then he came over, and I put the first layer on, but I have to leave. And I said, "What do you mean you have to leave? Oh, the general's waiting." And I go, "Oh, are you a member of the military?" Well, he was wearing civilian clothes, and then all of a sudden I noticed that his badge was slightly different than my badge. And I go, "Well," he says, "Yes, I'm a First Louis." And I said, "Well, would you like to leave now?" And he said, "But what were you doing here?" And he says, "Well, I wanted to find out what you were doing." And I said, "Well, now you know." And so I gave him permission to leave, and he started to leave, and laughter just followed him all the way down all 7 floors. And I said, "Well, did you guys know that he was a member of the military?" Mm-hmm. "Well, why didn't you say?" "Oh, Pam, you weren't letting us get a word in edgewise." So later that afternoon, I had a meeting, and the head of the base came down, and he said, "Pam, I understand that you had some assistance. And here, I'd only been with this company for maybe 6 to 9 weeks. And of that 6 or 9 weeks, I'd been traveling 6 weeks. So I go, "Oh, my God, I'm here all the way in Florida, and I'm not going to be able to get back to California because he's going to fire me, and I'm not going to have the money to go back home." And he goes, "Oh, no, Pam, don't worry about it." He says, "Anyone," because I had started to apologize, he says, "Anyone who can get the customer to do our work for us can come to work for him any time." But that was his way of saying, "Don't ever do that again."
Yeah, right. So you started watching badges more carefully after that.
But that's one of the few stories that I'm not going to be able to say tonight at the meeting.
Yeah, that's all right. But that's a good one. I like to see that, where we one-upsmanship on the customer. Yes, I never got a chance to do that, but that was fun.
Well, you don't want to do that. I believe that you don't want to do that.
Fortunately, I didn't have to do much traveling on my job for my company. I think it was one trip we took that was memorable. We had a meeting in St. Louis, followed by a meeting in Dayton, Ohio, on a proposal. And we wanted to meet with McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis about working with us on this proposal. It was a classified proposal, so we went to Dayton to Wright-Patterson to get all the poop about this proposal. 3 of us went. And it was another nice, hot Santa Ana week in Southern California. We're dying of the heat. We get on the airplane at 4 in the morning. We get to St. Louis, and it's snowing. It was 4 degrees that night. The next morning, it's still snowing in Dayton. Brr. We didn't sleep well. I had a diesel truck outside my room with an engine on all night. So we get to Dayton. We go into this classified meeting. They say, "No note-taking. You know, we'll send you something." They turn the lights out and start with a slide presentation. We all go, and between the 3 of us, I think we pieced it together, but they never sent us anything in the mail either. And we got on the airplane and went back to the heat. So that was enough traveling for me. That was hateful.
Well, I have been traveling since I've been working for Aerospace Corporation, which is the technical arm of the Air Force. I have been approving the parts that they're actually going to use or fly or whatever. And so I've been on a plane, must be about 9 months out of the 10 months that I've been working for.
And with the current flying restrictions, that must be really fun.
You spend all day getting to point A.
I'm so happy to be retired.
Well, I retired for one day and then started to work.
I did want to talk to you more about inspiring our future engineers. And how would you encourage women to become successful engineers? We having had such fun with our careers, how would you get the young ones interested able to do the kinds of work we do?
Well, I have mentored engineers all the time, and I have a whole gangle, gaggle, I think it's called. And I actually have 5 engineers over at Boeing, even though I'm no longer at Boeing. And every other Friday we meet, because that's when I have off, every other Friday. But getting young engineers, they need mentors.
And
they need to have someone take them underneath their arm and say, okay, now this is how it's done.
And they need to go to engineering school to get the skills that employers look for to get the jobs with.
Well, true.
Which is why I know that you've been working with the Girl Scouts on aerospace badges and things.
Oh, yeah. And when I do, I tell them how the rocket works and give out samples of the rocket. And they give me the samples back. And so forth, so that they actually can touch parts. When I was at McDonnell Douglas Boeing, I took them out to what was called the Boneyard and would show them parts that had been scrapped but were still, you know, seeable.
Yeah. I know when I was in high school, I lived in Westchester, which was the hub of the aerospace industry in Southern California.
At the time, it was.
When I was a kid. We had a class project to do, and I talked to my dad, and he said, here, I'll explain to you how a jet engine works, and you can make that your project. Well, spaghetti style, you know, he told me all about it, and it went in one ear, and when it came time to talk about it, it came out the other ear, and that was the end of it. But he helped me put together a report and pictures and all this stuff, and it made sense at the time. And it took a few more years before I fully grasped what he was telling me, but that was such a help. And it really got me interested in doing that kind of work. And I think giving kids, showing them what the stuff is and explaining how it works has got to get them excited about getting involved in it. And I know that the younger you start on them, the better.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you have been mentoring people at all ages.
I was really lucky every time I had a physics problem or a practical mechanical problem, I could call up Vonnegut Brown until he died. I like high school and college physics, you know.
That's great.
And say, Uncle Werner, help me. he wasn't really my uncle, but, you know.
Yeah, that's close enough. The only help I really got was about the time I was in my sophomore year and living at home, and a guy moved in across the street with some buddies, and he was 2 years ahead of me at UCLA Engineering, and he had all these old exams and papers and stuff. So he said, here, look through these.
Oh, boy, that was a real help. Now,
I was a better student than he was, but at least I got a clue what kind of questions they were asking, and it helped a bit.
Oh, I'm sure.
But not, you know, a great deal, but it was enough to get confidence that, oh, I can do that. I can do this. I can do the other. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I think he was going in electrical, which was not something I cared to even try to do. I stayed in mechanical-type engineering because it made sense to me. I could see what was going on. Electrical, electrons, come on. I don't believe it. It's like turning on a tap, watching the water come out. That I can see. I don't see the electrons. So that's about all the questions I can think of. Have you got some further comments that you want to add to our little discussion here?
Oh, if you get me started on the stories, you know, it'll be way too late. So how many more minutes? We only have five more minutes?
You can talk for 5 minutes.
Well, do you want the Einstein story?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
You mentioned his name. You got to tell us about him.
Okay.
Uncle Albert.
Uncle Albert, yeah. Well, as I said, we lived in Alamogordo, and I was about 4 years old at the time. And the doorbell rang, and I was just anticipating Uncle Vanna or Vanna Van Braun. And he brought a friend along. And so I yell out to my mom, "Hey, who's the guy with the teddy bear hair?" And it turns out it was Uncle Albert. My dad immediately introduced him as Uncle Albert, Albert Einstein. And then I had been real good that day, so I got to sit with the adults, and I sat right next to Uncle Albert. And about three quarters of the way through dinner, he must have gotten an idea. And he went down to his watch pocket and pulled out a thin steno pad. And still attached to his watch fob, because I guess he was always losing his notes. And he started to write. Well, writing at the table was forbidden. So I put my little hand down, and he said, "That's not nice. Mommy doesn't like that." And the silence was sort of deafening. And immediately, an exception was made for Albert Einstein and me. It was the one and only night I got to write at the table. And so later that night, I was watching television. And all the science fiction shows way back then, this was in the early 1950s, had E equals MC squared prominently shown. And when I had questions on math or science, I'd always ask my mother, who was a full professor of nursing arts. But she would usually say, "Well, why don't you ask her Uncle Vanna the next time, you see?" And hoping that I would forget because, you know, precocious children never forget, of course. And so just as this was occurring, who would walk in but Uncle Albert? So I went running over to the TV. "Look, look, look, look. Do you know what that is? You're an uncle."
You
and
know
he
is.
Sat down and said, "Well, perhaps." And invited me to sit on his lap, which I took as an extra invitation to investigate his hair, because my mom wasn't around not to tell me. Not to do it. I mean, I knew not to do it, but it was too tempting. And so he takes out his steno pad again and starts to write. And at the end of each page, he asks, "Well, did you understand?" And I go, "Yeah," so that I could continue playing with his hair. Now, I don't quite understand why, at the age of four, he was telling me the theory of relativity, since all I knew at that time was my ABCs in both English and German and my numbers in both languages, but and little short addition and subtraction, but no higher math. However, his trip was extremely brief and very, very secret, and because of that, no pictures were allowed, so maybe he wanted to give me something to remember him by. And unfortunately, I didn't last my many, many moves because I could have used them in graduate school.
I would think so.
But at 27 pages later, he finally said, "Well, did I really understand?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I thought it was a great bedtime story. Did you have any more?" I wanted to keep on playing with his hair.
Other people would have thought it as a sign of...
Well, I still think it's a great bedtime story.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And thank you very, very much, Phyllis.
Sure.
I really enjoyed
it. Pam, it's fun. We talk a lot. We know each other pretty well, and it was fun to do this.
Yes, it was.